Weirded Out in Mexico, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wants to renegotiate NAFTA or maybe terminate it. It's confusing. Here's the reaction in Mexico.
I think the word is bemused, disappointed, sort of weirded out.
Also, a health clinic in Toronto offers heroin addicts a safe space to take drugs.
It's the best place for something wrong to go because we're going to be able to step in, save that person's life, and that person will get to live another day.
Plus, a TV crew in Norway is following a herd of migrating reindeer for a week, and they're getting creative.
They tried to put a camera on one reindeer. The problem was that the other reindeers were scared of that reindeer with the camera because it made some funny moves.
An intentionally slow news day in Norway, and more on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. Last night, the Trump administration said it would scrap NAFTA. And then, apparently, after some emergency phone calls with the Mexican president and the Canadian prime minister, Trump decided to stick with NAFTA. Kinda.
So I decided rather than terminating NAFTA, which would be a pretty big, you know, shock to the system, we will renegotiate. Now, if I'm unable to make a fair deal, for the United States, meaning a fair deal for our workers and our companies, I will terminate NAFTA.
With me now on the phone from Mexico City is entrepreneur and political commentator Agustin Barrios Gomez. So we're confused whether Trump wants to scrap NAFTA or renegotiate it somehow. How confused are you and other Mexicans? Or are you still taking this threat that NAFTA might die seriously?
I think the word is bemused, disappointed, sort of weirded out.
Yeah. And the disappointment comes in where?
NAFTA was an American project. It was Ronald Reagan's initiative. Originally, he was the one who invited Mexico to a free trade agreement. So it's the sort of thing where you're just like, okay, so you asked me to join your sphere of influence. After many, many years, we actually do so. And then it turns out that you want to change the rules, despite the fact that, of course, you are basically the world's largest economy. So you're the elephant in the room. You're the one who has all of these benefits. And yet ignorance about NAFTA becomes a rallying cry in one of your presidential elections.
Well, how do you respond to Trump saying that NAFTA is a horrible deal for the U.S. and great for Mexico and Canada?
Well, he doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. Obviously, every serious study of NAFTA actually shows a net job gain for the United States. There are 14 million American jobs that directly depend on NAFTA. 14 million, okay?
Mr. Barrios Gomez, there have been people in the United States who have lost their jobs, and a lot of
and
those
in Mexico, too.
What kind of jobs have been lost in Mexico due to NAFTA?
A lot of agricultural jobs. A lot of subsistence and corn farmers were completely obliterated. But here's how I look at it. So, you know, as a politician, I was a federal congressman in the last legislature. So if I go to somebody, like a woman who works in a factory somewhere in Querétaro or in Aguascalientes or whatever, and I say to her, okay, I want to protect my corn farmers. So I'm going to have you who actually have to compete with everybody around the world, you who have to compete successfully with China and all of these different people, I'm going to have you pay more for your tortillas, and I'm going to have you pay more for the food on your table because I want to protect these farmers that are not competitive on a world scale instead of actually buying from Iowa. How can I look her in the eye and ask her to sacrifice when she's actually doing what she needs to do to get ahead?
So yesterday evening, when Trump announced he was going to scrap NAFTA before he had those phone calls, the peso immediately fell. I'm just wondering how the business sector in Mexico reacts to Trump.
See, the business community is naturally sanguine. Business people have a tendency to be optimistic. That's why entrepreneurs actually risk their capital and all that. And so what they keep turning around and saying, look, it's so obviously of detriment to the United States to get out of NAFTA that this is all rhetoric. And I don't think so. I mean, I think that politics will trump pragmatism and reality.
Your dad was an ambassador, I read, and you grew up in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, so you've lived in all three NAFTA countries.
Right.
What's at stake if these three countries can't work together?
Absolutely everything, from national security to economic prosperity. Your program is called The World, right? So, as you know, around the world, it is very strange to have three countries that actually share these common values of democracy, that share cultural heritage. These three countries were born together. The U.S. dollar sign is the Mexican peso sign. We are as old as each other, and we have created a team. To break that up is to put under heavy strain and possibly break the ties that bind.
Mexican entrepreneur Agustin Barrios Gomez, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Mark.
There's one trade that's been booming between Mexico and the United States, and that's the drug trade, specifically heroin. U.S. demand for the drug has tripled since 2010, and Mexican producers and traffickers are rushing to keep up. Now the U.S. is considering a new approach, assisting Mexico with the eradication of poppy fields. Deborah Bonello is covering the story for Insight Crime, an investigative group that specializes in reporting on organized crime. Deborah joins us from Mexico City. So what exactly is being proposed?
Well, Marco, the new development is based on comments by William Brownfield, who, as you know, is the U.S. Assistant Secretary for INL, the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Agency. And he said in an interview that this is being discussed, you know, the idea that the U.S. would put money towards increased eradication efforts by the Mexican government. So I think these comments by Brownfield are a show of will on the part of the U.S. government to kind of, you know, take Mexico's hand on that, as it has in so many other parts of this bilateral drug problem.
How does eradicating poppy fields, though, help in fighting pharmaceutical opioid addiction in the U.S.?
That's a good question. I think it's been well documented now, most eloquently, I think, by Sam Quiñones in his book Dreamlands, that the boom in heroin addiction in the U.S. has been fed by addicts switching from prescription painkillers such as OxyContin to cheap Mexican heroin. Now, I guess, you know, law enforcement would argue that if they can reduce the availability of different types of Mexican heroin on the streets of the U.S., then they're going to reduce the level of addiction. You could also argue that it might be as effective to attack the supply of these prescription pills in the U.S. and clamp down harder on the pharmaceuticals who are pushing that market.
Ultimately, how does reducing supply help? Won't it just drive up the price?
I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, all these arguments about the effectiveness of various facets of the war on drugs, you know, and I think eradication is one of those, are absolutely credible. I mean, you know, the thing to remember is that people who grow opium poppy in Guerrero are, you know, the beginning of the chain. But I've been up there with them. I've spoken to the farmers who do it, you know, very humble people who are aware of the impact of what they're doing. But at the same time, they feel that they have very few alternatives to support their families. And until those alternatives transpire and are, you know, realistic alternatives to them, then it's hard to see them doing anything else.
I know it's been happening for at least a decade, but for the U.S., Mexico is now the major heroin supplier and a producer. How long did it take for Mexico to ramp up its poppy cultivation to this degree?
Going by Mexico official figures, it's hard to say because they've only just started producing those figures. But my understanding is that that surge has been in the last 5 years. The thing is that, you know, Brownfield said that more than 90% now of the heroin comes through Mexico, from Mexico, but that's not necessarily being produced in Mexico. And because it's an unregulated industry, it's very difficult to identify the origin sometimes. So, you know, Mexico is a key producer, but it's also still a key transit nation for a lot of heroin coming from other parts of Latin America.
Should we be surprised that the Mexican government is even willing to consider cooperating with the Trump administration on this, given the strain in relations in almost every other field?
I mean, yeah, it's hard to know what's going through Enrique Peña Nieto's mind some of the time with the kind of position that he has been put in and put himself in with Trump. So, yeah, I mean, relations between Mexico and the U.S. are not at their best. You know, Trump did seem to be able to pull a diplomatic crisis out of nowhere. So far, there's been no clear signal from the Trump administration on what's going to happen with that going forward.
Deborah Bonello of Insight Crime speaking with us from Mexico City. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Across North America, overdose deaths from opioid drugs like heroin and fentanyl are skyrocketing. In Canada, they're taking a new approach to dealing with the crisis. The Canadian government has promised to give several large cities permission to set up clinics where people can go to inject illegal drugs without facing charges. It's something that's been done in Vancouver for years. Now Toronto is among the cities that plans to set up supervised injection clinics. From Toronto, Anita Elash has that story.
We're actually just kind of coming up to the garbage piles where this is sort of right here.
Amy Wright doesn't use drugs anymore, but when she did, she'd sometimes come here to shoot up heroin and morphine. A back alley in Toronto's downtown core, lined with enormous dumpsters and littered with trash.
It's dark, it's gray, it's dim, it's dirty. In the summer, you'll really start to smell it because of the garbage, and you'll smell the urine, and as you can see, there's crap on the door.
For a homeless addict desperate for a hit, this is a great place to hide.
Because as you notice, only one guy has walked through, so somebody could have done a number of fixes by now without being bothered by anybody.
It's private, but it's also dangerous. This is where one of Wright's closest friends died after injecting heroin.
He overdosed and nobody found him.
Wright says her friend struggled to get off heroin. She believes he would have survived if he had a safe injection site to go to. The city plans to open three of the sites as soon as it gets the go-ahead from the Canadian government. One will be at this health clinic in Toronto's West End.
So the supervised injection site is really right off the main lobby, just to the left.
Lorraine Barnaby is the site coordinator. She says drug users will first get screened by a nurse. If they're approved, they'll get a kit with clean needles, and then they'll go to a booth to inject while a nurse watches. If it's needed, the nurse can even help with the injection.
For example, we could apply the tourniquet to their arm. We could help them raise the vein so they can visibly see the vein, or they can actually feel the vein. We can show them how to feel for a vein. We can help them locate actual viable veins. We can walk them through the preparation of their drugs. But what we can't do is we can't physically insert the needle into them. We can't push the plunger.
That may sound extreme, but Barnaby says it's no different than teaching a diabetic how to safely inject insulin. The goal here is to reduce the health risks that can come with injection drug use. Everything from abscesses to the spread of HIV. And she says it will prevent overdoses.
Something goes wrong, it's the best place for something wrong to go. Because we're going to be able to step in, save that person's life, and that person will get to live another day.
Critics worry the sites will encourage more drug use and attract addicts to the neighborhood, but that hasn't happened in other cities. There's been a supervised injection site in Vancouver on Canada's west coast for 13 years. Drug use in public and discarded needles around that site have actually decreased. And research shows that people who use the site are more likely to eventually go into rehab. Amy Wright lived in Vancouver and says she used the supervised injection site there a lot. She says it saved her girlfriend from an overdose. And it's one of the reasons Wright finally quit using.
I would go in and I would do my hit, and then I'd go talk to the counselors, or I'd go talk to the nurses, and I'd get my arm checked out or something like that. But I was always talking to the counselors about wanting to change, and so they were giving me all these ideas, and it was like, get your name in this detox bed, get your name in this detox bed. Like, from that I started to learn like why I was using.
Wright has since earned a social work degree. She's a harm reduction worker at a women's shelter, and now she's helping the city of Toronto design its safe injection sites. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
Coming up, the Chinese billionaire who's a member of Mar-a-Lago. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Since he took office, Donald Trump has welcomed a lot of high rollers and foreign dignitaries to his Florida golf club, Mar-a-Lago. Chinese President Xi Jinping made headlines when he met Trump there a few weeks ago. There's one Chinese billionaire, though, who is already a Mar-a-Lago member. He's Guo Wengui, and he's got a penchant for promising to expose corruption among top Chinese Communist Party officials. Isaac Stonefish often joins us to talk about all things China. He's a journalist and a senior fellow at the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. So, Isaac, tell us about this guy. Who is he, and how much is he worth?
He is a 50-year-old, very wealthy man, the man responsible for developing a massive hotel complex near the Olympic Village in China that had more stars than I thought was possibly available for stars. You know, they go 5, they go 6, they go 7. This might have been 8 stars. We know that he is wealthy enough to pay for Mar-a-Lago, to pay for other Tony clubs around the world. He claims to have 11 passports.
Wow.
And he claims to have a thick file of really devastating information that would be really, really embarrassing for many people in power and recently in power at the top of the Chinese Communist Party.
So what has Guo brought to light and how worrying is it all for Beijing?
He has said that he has evidence of relatives of top Communist Party officials that have some quite shady dealings, certainly been enough to take down other officials. We have to be careful because the evidence that he has so far provided has not yet been backed up. He does have a penchant for exaggeration. On the other hand, he played in this space, and there's so much dirt and wrongdoing that potentially happened that I think some of his allegations are going to turn out to be true. There's an expression in Chinese, original sin. And in this case, it doesn't mean the leaving of the Garden of Eden, but rather it means the crimes that wealthy people in China had to make in order to become rich. And Guo seems to have evidence showing some of the crimes that very wealthy people in China have made in order to build their fortunes.
So presumably, Isaac, it's the Communist Party that must have helped Guo lubricate his kind of acquisition of a lot of real estate.
Indeed. He formerly had really close ties with a now fallen top Chinese public security official. And after that official fell, Guo thought it was prudent to leave the country.
Where is he right now? Do we know?
He has a very nice apartment in Manhattan and I think a lot of really nice real estate in other parts of the world. I think Guo is going to be more careful about being public with where he is because he's probably afraid of some sort of reprisal from Chinese agents, even if he's in the United States.
So how has Guo managed to get as far as he did, kind of biting the hand that feeds him without being put in check by Beijing?
I think maybe he had successfully transferred enough money out of China or into a bank account that he felt secure. Maybe there was something about Trump being president that made him decide that he could speak out. But it's really not something that we've seen before. And Guo really could be a lightning rod for a lot of dissatisfaction people have with the way the Communist Party does business.
What does this do as a weight on Chinese President Xi Jinping? Like, is it going to affect his ability to work on other pressing issues like dealing with Trump and the U.S. or reigning in North Korea?
So some of the allegations center on relatives of Wang Qishan. Wang is the one who's been tasked with running Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign. So at the very least, if Guo turns out to have anything that's damning about Wang Qishan, it could affect Xi Jinping's ability domestically to move as aggressively as he'd like with his corruption campaign, or could also cause him to lose some respect for the way he's trying to clean up China.
And finally, Isaac, the Trump connection, as I said, Guo is a member of the Mar-a-Lago resort. Does that affect any U.S.-China diplomatic dance right now?
You know, it really shouldn't because it's really inappropriate that someone who's paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to a company that Trump owns to have any effect on U.S.-China relations. But you got to think it makes Trump more sympathetic to him and that Trump is more likely to be aware of this person.
I would guess, though, when Xi Jinping and Trump were having dinner at Mar-a-Lago, Guo was nowhere near the state of Florida.
I think so. I think perhaps he was on the golf course, though, looking in and gazing on the Dover sole that they were eating and wanting to be a part of the conversation. Who knows?
Isaac Stonefish, a senior fellow at the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Great to chat, Marco. Thank you.
Sometimes you find compelling stories right in your own backyard. I live in Cambridge, not far from our studios here. My neighborhood's changed a lot since I moved there 15 years ago. Of course, when you're that close to it, it's often hard to see. But then something unexpected happens and the changes stand out, like when the mechanic who knows my car inside and out has to leave the neighborhood. His garage, 2 blocks from my apartment, is never this quiet. It's usually busy with the noises of revving motors or power tools. Today is moving day, though, and it feels a little glum.
My name's Guang. last name Lin, and I became Cambridge about 22 years.
Guang has been my rock ever since I drove my 97 Jeep with manual transmission into his garage more than a decade ago. Each time it needed a repair, he wouldn't just fix it. He'd hang on to the offending part and explain later what went wrong. Guang was 16 when he opened his first car repair place in Hong Kong.
It started in Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong. And how many years did you have the business in Hong Kong before you moved to the U.S.?
About 4 years.
So what's it been like living in this neighborhood? Because it's changed a lot since you've been here, 22 years, right?
Oh, big different. Because before 1995, I'd be here, all the land, all the parking lot space, now all the condo, the big building.
I've been watching that happen for a while. Guang's garage was very close to MIT. This neighborhood used to mostly be three-family homes, a few converted lofts, a couple of convenience stores, and other garages. The Car Talk guys used to have their shop 2 blocks from Guang. But like my old Jeep, the neighborhood has gone from analog to digital. There are lots of new tech startups. Google and Facebook are nearby. And as Guang said, condos are popping up everywhere. How does it make you feel, all these changes in this neighborhood?
I feel no good. No room, too much people, you know, the street traffic. I don't feel good because I lost my customer. The customer, he can't find a good mechanic.
Yeah, can't find a good mechanic and probably won't find a garage with this. In the back of Guang's garage, squeezed in between metal shelves with spare parts, is his version of a koi pond. Right now, he's got at least a dozen beauties, including a koi that is pearl white with a few black and gold spots. That one swims in a tub on the floor as big as a jacuzzi.
It's just so wonderful. You step out of the garage and suddenly it's like you're in a garden.
Oh, yeah, because sometimes you're very busy. You have a lot of pressure. You need to look at the fish, and that's good for relaxing. And the young people, young kid, everyone come to Guang to see my fish.
Guang, thanks a lot. We're really going to miss you in the neighborhood, really.
Thank you very much. I appreciate my customer, my neighbor, everyone to support me about 22 years. I really, really, really sad too.
Yeah, it is sad. Guang and his crew and his fish left my neighborhood for good this week. But he's got a new garage just south of Boston in the same neighborhood where he lives. Each time I walk by the new condos that will be built where Guang's garage used to be, though, I'll be thinking how delightful it was when he was there. I'd get my car repaired hassle-free, and I could go behind his counter and be at one with the air filters, spark plugs, and the koi. I'm Marco Werman. The Texas House of Representatives passes a bill banning local towns and cities from offering sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. This lawmaker thinks it's a big mistake.
When we look back upon this 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years from now, a lot of us are going to say, why did we do that?
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 16 hours. That's how long lawmakers in Texas debated a bill yesterday. Just one sign of how controversial SB 4 is. It did get initial approval at 3 this morning, but the bill still has several other legislative hurdles to get over before it becomes law. As I said, it's controversial, so SB 4 has stirred a lot of emotions in Texas. It would allow, among other things, police officers to ask about the immigration status of the people they arrest. One of the bill's opponents is Representative Gene Wu of Houston. Here's some of his testimony yesterday at the State House.
This topic is painful for me because I'm an immigrant. My parents are immigrants. I represent a district filled with immigrants.
Gene Wu joins us. Representative Wu, this has been a pretty emotional couple of days for you. We just heard your testimony in the Texas State House from yesterday. Could you just talk a bit first about what it was like to be up there talking so frankly about these things?
It was very difficult. I mean, this is basically a personal issue with many of the people who opposed the bill. I think many of the Republicans saw this as just doing business, taking care of stuff that the governor wanted. But for many Democrats, this was personal because just like myself, many Democrats here are immigrants or sons of immigrants. Anna Hernandez from Houston herself was an undocumented immigrant for quite a while before becoming a citizen. So it was painful.
So tell us about SB 4, this bill, and why it raises so many strong feelings for you.
I think this is a part of a larger national, if not global, trend to sort of attack immigration. I think a lot of people see their problems in life and they want someone to blame. And, you know, immigrants are always a convenient punching bag. This is true in England. This is true in France. And, you know, it's true in the United States.
Specifically, what does this bill do?
So originally, when it came out of the House committee, the bill was merely dealing with criminals, people who were arrested for a crime or at least suspected of a crime. What was amended on the floor, what it became, is now an Arizona-style show me your papers type of law, where any time a law enforcement officer interacts with you, they're able to ask you for papers and ask you for identification. And the law, in fact, prohibits police departments or cities or counties from having a policy that says, hey, if you're just talking to somebody and you're just asking, seeing if they're a victim or not, you're not allowed to ask if they have papers. This is going to cause a real problem for our communities.
Yeah. How will SB4 impact the people in your own district?
I represent a large immigrant district. You know, 40% of the adults in my district are not U.S. born. Most people are documented. They might be immigrants who are citizens, and some of them might be undocumented. What it's going to do is it's going to cause people to live in fear. We already have a hard enough time right now with the current law for people to come forward when they've been victimized, to come forward when they've witnessed a crime, and to even show up to court when they've been requested to do so to help prosecute cases.
You know, you spoke about a lot of your background last night. And as I watched your testimony, I found it really hard to reconcile the fact that this bill will affect a lot of people in Texas. And yet you made very clear the connection from these really negative moments in U.S. history, Chinese Exclusion Act of the 1880s or the internment of Japanese during World War II. And yet this bill passed anyway. Help me understand that.
You know, I think this is a prime example of good people who I think do a bad thing. That even when you're talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act and about Japanese internment, the people who voted for that, the people who supported that, they thought they were doing the right thing. They said the same thing. They said, we're just protecting our communities. We're just protecting our nation. We're just trying to do what we feel like we need to do to be safe, because they were in fear, because they were scared, because they were angry. And it's really no different. What I was trying to say by bringing up those points is this is not the first time our nation has passed laws in anger, that our nation has passed laws out of fear, that when we look back upon this 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years from now, that a lot of us are going to say, why did we do that?
Texas State House Representative Gene Wu, he represents Southwest Houston. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the illegal drug trade between the U.S. and Mexico. Here's another part of the world with another drug problem. This next story takes us to Southeast Asia, where the illicit drug of choice is methamphetamine. It's called Yaba, little pink meth pills. It's popular and it's big business. Sales are booming, even in some unexpected places. The world's Patrick Wynn travels to the world's hottest new market for meth.
This is the balmy coast of Bangladesh, a sleepy, swampy sort of place. If you look around at the moms wearing hijabs, the farm boys snoozing in the shade, you wouldn't think, this looks like a great place to score some meth. But it is. In fact, it's one of the hottest new meth markets in the world, and a place so conservative that even beer is illegal. I'm here to meet a border guard force. Their mission today? Catching smugglers, bringing in meth on boats. Rifles cocked, we head to a river called the Naaf. We're in a wooden dinghy, paddling around, scanning for suspicious activity. On the far shore, Myanmar, the heartland of Asia's meth production. The river is a major trafficking route out of Myanmar. It's also a place where smugglers hide drugs in plain sight. They say that there's meth packed in watertight plastic packages underneath the water, waiting to be retrieved by traffickers. The tricky part is they don't know where they are. The meth is sold in tiny pink pills that smell like cake frosting. They're called yaba. Most people smoke them off a piece of foil. A decade ago, meth was pretty rare in Bangladesh. In 1 year, they might confiscate 35,000 pills. Last year, they seized 29 million pills, enough meth to get everyone in Texas high. Back at the shoreline, we hear that another unit up the river just caught some smugglers. So we rush back to the base, where we see the two suspects, bound with rope, looking roughed up. One guy is leaking blood from his foot. In the next room, I find the regional commander, Lieutenant Colonel Abuzar Al-Zahid. He's a big, bear-like man, yet he still struggles to tear open the waterproof bundle of drugs. It's covered in endless layers of plastic and tape.
This is a plastic bag, inside another bag. So they have just modified and put the yaba at the bottom.
I mean, they did a pretty good job of hiding it, but not good enough.
It's cat and mouse game, you can tell.
I noticed the room has an interesting smell.
That's the smell of yaba. This is the smell of cookies, and it's very alluring, isn't it?
These days, the border guard sees so much meth that they barely know what to do with it. So they've just been digging massive holes behind the station and filling them up with pills. Then they take confiscated bottles of whiskey, smash them, and pour booze on top of the pills. The outcome? A large pit filled with noxious pink goo. Have you been surprised to see people become so fond of methamphetamine?
The narcotics businessmen, they are relentlessly working on it. They are alluring the young people. So even they are Muslims, they go for this, taking these narcotics.
For Asia's drug syndicates, Bangladesh is an attractive market. It's got 160 million people, all crammed into a country smaller than Illinois. That's a lot of potential buyers. And out here in the marshlands, there's not much to do but work the fields, pray, maybe play some cricket. A Bangladeshi journalist I've been traveling with, named Romeo, he tells me meth has brought a menacing vibe to many small villages. I'm keen to see this for myself. So we leave the border guards and drive deep into the countryside. There, we find a group of young guys idling by the river. One of them is wearing shades, oozing teenage swagger. Romeo says he looks like trouble, so of course, that's the one I approach.
How are you? Fine?
I'm good. How are you?
One selfie, please. One selfie.
Oh, sure, sure, sure. After we take a selfie, I bring up yaba, and he starts telling me all about the village addicts. Romeo translates.
They sold everything from their house to buy yaba pills. They've gone just mad to procure yaba.
But when I ask the kid if he's tried the drug, he gets defensive.
So he says that, yes, there's kind of hype when they take, but I don't know, because I never use it, so I can tell you this.
Suddenly, we're surrounded by more than a dozen teenage boys. I can see that Romeo is on edge. Hey, you want to see some meth, the boys say? Just come with us behind that wall. We'll show you. Sensing danger, Romeo hustles me back to our van.
Nah. Let's go.
Okay.
Uncle. Right. Uncle. Nah.
That was odd. What just happened?
Probably they want to attack us. So it's not safe right at the moment, so we have to go. They say, oh, come, I will show. But I'm sure whenever we'll go there, they will snatch away my camera and my wallets and everything.
Romeo tells me it's like this all over now. Sleepy villages are falling under the spell of cheap speed.
The situation is really horrible.
For The World, Patrick Nguyen, TechNov, Bangladesh.
You can find out how Bangladeshi border guards get rid of all that seized meth. We've got a video at PRI.org. Once a year, we here in the U.S. fire up the TV and watch a slowly burning Yule log. you know, the virtual fireplace. But I got to say, Norway one-ups the U.S. on this. They love their slow TV any time of year. In the past, you could watch an entire night of knitting, not to mention the full 8-hour train ride from Bergen to Oslo. The latest edition of slow TV features reindeer 24/7. Per Inge Aasen is a project manager for Norway's slow TV channel.
Hello, hello. I haven't seen the reindeer except from the television because I'm one of the link teams. So we have to be here up on the mountaintops with antennas. So the signal from the program where the reindeers are is going up to the rest of the world. So we are some antenna link teams. It's windy up here. I'm trying to stand so the wind is behind me.
Very cool. All right. So you're seeing the reindeer on your monitors. What's the latest? If I were to turn on slow TV today, what would I see?
Earlier today, they tried to put a camera on one reindeer. But I don't know if that was so successful because the problem was that the other reindeers were scared of that reindeer with the camera because it made some funny moves. So the camera reindeer scared away the other reindeers.
Oh, wow. That's slow TV, isn't it? What is
yeah.
What is the idea behind slow TV in Norway?
The Norwegian Broadcasting started with slow TV a couple of years ago. At first, it was following a train. I think the idea behind slow TV is in the stressful world we are living in, it's so good to just sit down to put on a channel where it just happens in the nature speed. The other thing is that it's very exciting that it's not the people who decide something will happen. It's the reindeers and the weather.
Is it popular? I mean, do you have a lot of viewers?
It seems that it's very popular. And I think you foreigners think about our Norwegians as stupid people who look at it.
Not at all. In fact, I do wonder how Americans would react if they had the chance to watch reindeer or like a bear 24/7.
Yeah, but I suppose you in America look at this program because it's available on net.
Right. So how do you decide what viewers will watch?
Because this is a story that's happening every year here in our area. And it's a natural thing for the reindeer herders. And we wanted to share this experience with the rest of the people who don't have the chance to be on a migration like this. When I've been here on the mountaintops and looked on television, I feel some proudness to do this impossible live television.
What does it look like when you see this herd of reindeer? Are there a lot of them?
Yeah, it's 1,000 or 1,500 reindeers. Mm. The thing is, we have some special cameras who follow the reindeers, and we also have drones from the air, and it's spectacular pictures, especially when the weather is like this. And it's sunny, so it's a perfect day.
Yeah.
You have to go to our website and look at this.
I will, for sure. Mm. So how does the program end? Do you have any idea?
Oh, yeah. These reindeers, their summer area is on an island. So the great final is that they will swim over the ocean. It's called Sund in Norwegian.
That's going to be a pretty spectacular end to this episode.
And my dream is when the reindeers swim over to the island, then the first rain calf will be born. That would be very... Because that's the nature thing of reindeers, female reindeer. They start to move north to born rain calf, reindeer calf. Wow, it's an amazing thing to look at.
Per Inge Aasen, the project manager for Norway's Slow TV channel. Take it slow, man.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Filmmaker Jonathan Demme lost his fight with cancer, as we found out yesterday. Demme has been mourned in Hollywood, but also in many places far from the limelight, including Haiti. In mid-career, Demme produced two films about Haiti, and Jocelyn McCalla was one of the countless Haitians he befriended. McCalla directs the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. He first met Demme when the filmmaker was working on his 1988 documentary, Haiti Dreams of Democracy.
He was very respectful of Haitians and took a backseat to what they wanted to do. He was a real great behind-the-scenes advocate with Hollywood, with politicians, in making sure that Haiti was seen in the better light.
Historically, a really interesting and heady time in Haiti. The Duvalier dictatorship was over after 30 years. I mean, it must have been really eye-opening to see Haiti for the first time for Jonathan Demme in that time.
Well, it was. No, in fact, I think what most impressed him was the vitality. A lot of people who had been dreaming of democracy were in a situation where they could make it happen. And I can tell you that that was the case for me as well. I mean, I had long labored for democracy to happen. And so we were full of hope, and the music exploded. I think that's one of the things that impressed Jonathan Demme. And he fell in love with the art. He fell in love with the generosity of the people who embraced him and considered him, didn't treat him as, sort of a star, but one of their own.
That's Jocelyn McCalla, director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. Writer Amy Wallens also counted herself among Jonathan Demme's friends. Her latest book is called Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Wallens says doors would open for Demme because of his style.
He always could get in wherever he wanted to, and he was so interested in everything, and he showed that to people. He showed that he was not a big foreigner intruding, but a person who actually had intellectual curiosity. Of course, he was a filmmaker, and everybody loves a filmmaker. Nobody rejects you out of hand because right. You're making a movie.
Amid all the mentions of Silence of the Lambs, there are posts by people talking about Demme in Haiti, the videos he made for the anti-apartheid Sun City Project, or his advocacy for refugees. What do you think it was that gave Jonathan Demme this wide humanitarian worldview that you just don't find that much among most Hollywood directors?
No, you don't. I remember when I was talking to Sean Penn after the earthquake, and Sean had come down to Haiti, and he said, I remember Jonathan Demme used to always come and say, Haiti this, Haiti that, Haiti this, and I didn't understand what he was talking about, but now I know. And I think that Hollywood was very surprised by Demme's attachment to causes and to people who were not as well off as Hollywood people.
It's been a while since I saw his documentary, The Agronomist, about a Haitian radio journalist and human rights activist named Jean Dominique. It was pretty astonishing. Here's a clip from the trailer.
My country has been kicked by a bunch of thieves.
There were orders to shoot Jean on sight.
Twice I was summoned to the police. It was exciting. It was something carefully planned to kill democracy.
To him, it was for the Haitian people to have a say.
Every morning, you have to smell the enemy. Never forget that. You are from this land. You are not French. You are not British. You are not American. You are Haitian.
You are not French, you are not British, you are not American, you are Haitian. Part of the trailer there from the film The Agronomist about a charismatic Haitian hero and his extraordinary partner Michel Montas. So Amy Wallens, apparently Jonathan Demme used to tell a story about what happened one New Year's Day when he called Jean Dominique. Tell us about that.
So Jonathan had been working on this documentary about Jean, who was really a fabulous and charismatic figure and very important in the democracy movement in Haiti. And they had just wrapped it, and then Jean was killed, assassinated at the very courtyard of his radio station in downtown Port-au-Prince. And I went to a memorial for Jean Dominique, and Jonathan was there, and they were showing clips from the film. And Jonathan spoke a little bit afterwards, and he told this story. So he said, one day while they were working on the film, and he was in Nyack, New York, where he lived, and Jean was down in Port-au-Prince, it was New Year's. And Jonathan thought, oh, I should call Jean. Mm. It's New Year's. It's a big deal in Haiti, too. So he calls up Jean, and he says, Jean, Happy New Year. And he hears a pause on the other end of the line, and then Jean goes, Jonathan, what is your agenda? And Jonathan goes, Jean, I don't have an agenda. I'm calling to wish you Happy New Year.
That's it.
Of course, this is a story about Haitians and Americans working together, but it's also a great story about Jonathan, because Jonathan didn't have an agenda. He was just a friend, and he was just calling. And this was just another example of his great innocence in dealing with people. And I think that's a lot of what made him such a great filmmaker.
He had a continuing relationship with Haiti. He made another documentary called Dreams of Democracy about the country. And you've even mentioned that at the end of Demme's film, Rachel Getting Married, it's got kind of what you call a Haitian attitude. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I recall, at the end of the movie, there's like a dance party after Rachel gets married.
Right. I remember
Does
that.
She get married? I think she gets married.
I think she gets married.
And there's a big dance party in the backyard. And everybody's dancing, but they're not just dancing. There is, in Vodou celebrations in Haiti, after a ceremony, there's dancing. And there's a, in every Vodou temple, there's a pole that comes down the center of the temple, which is the pole that the gods descend. And it's called the middle pole, the poteau mitant. And at the end of Rachel getting married, I swear, there's a poteau mitant, and they're all dancing around it. And when I put up my little homage to Jonathan on Facebook, another friend wrote that if you look at Rachel getting married, all throughout, there are musical figures from all over the world whom Jonathan has featured, both present at parties in the movie and also their music in the score. So that's just, he welcomed everybody to this big, as we say in Haiti, bamboche, which means a party at the end.
Writer Amy Wilentz, remembering her friend, filmmaker Jonathan Demme. Thank you very much, Amy.
Thanks a lot.
Si Haïti pas forêt, où join tout bête la dame.
We'll end today with one of the Haitian musicians Demme brought into his bamboche, Mano Charlemagne. His music is featured in Demme's documentary, Haiti Dreams of Democracy, and he later played a maitre d' in Demme's The Truth About Charlie. Charlemagne was also elected mayor of Port-au-Prince in the 1990s. Anyway, here he is singing Haïti pas forêt, or Haiti is not a forest. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
L'or fait ça ma peur, parce que c'est ma coutou comprendre nous cap cap on aime. Ou râle ou zi ou la, moi relaxou, ou râle baton gayak la, moi bicoule sou, c'est vrai, ton aime. L'or fait ça ma peur, parce que c'est ma coutou comprendre nous cap cap on aime. Ou râle ou zi ou la.
PRI, Public Radio International.